Well, I am glad that you were able to make it today. It is July 3rd, and tomorrow is our exciting Independence Day. Except I think for most of us, it's probably going to be a wet one. But that's okay. It doesn't take away the day at all. I was working on our message. It's called Brave. And I do have some slides. I think David is working on getting them up. But what happens when you look at things and you think that you are brave? One of the things that comes to mind is that we have been given legs. And this man, his name was Marvin Kittman. He said, if God wanted us to be brave, why did he give us legs? Now, the moral of the story is, with legs, we can flee from battle. We can go away from what we need to deal with. But thinking about July 4th, thanks, David, July 4th, I don't think God gave us legs to flee. I think he gave us legs to stand firm. He gave us legs to move forward into the places he wants us to go. And bravery, Aesop says, it's easy to be brave from a safe distance. But Nelson Mandela says, I learned that courage was not the absence of fear, but the triumph over it. The brave man is not he who does not feel afraid, but he who conquers the fear. It's apropos for what we think about for July 4th, for the sacrifices that were made for our freedom, freedom of the people of the United States of America. And many individuals gave their lives and their families and everything to be able to give us this freedom. In the Bible, there's another person that put her life on the line in order to give her people freedom. And it's her name is Esther. And Esther just happens to be a powerful story of faith, courage, and obedience to God's will, even though God is not mentioned in the book. Interesting, right? It's one of the only books of the Bible that God is not mentioned in. But if you are facing a seemingly impossible challenge in your life right now, the story of Esther is exactly what is needed. I find it interesting that God helped me choose the book of Esther months ago, and it's exactly what I need to know. All week long, it's exactly what I needed to hear. So I think that there's some things that we can glean from the book of Esther as a whole today. Let's pray. Jesus, thank you for this time. Thank you for this freedom. I personally appreciate that we can talk about God and don't have to worry about people running in on us, dragging me off, putting me in jail for years and years. And I hope that I will continue to stand for you, to use the legs you gave me to be brave, even when I don't feel brave. In Jesus' name, amen. Well, Esther, even though God's name is never mentioned, it has his fingerprints, his handiwork all over it. The book of Esther takes place in 486 BC, so about 500 years before Jesus came on the scene. And it's in a place called Persia. I'll explain that in just a second. But I was struggling with how to talk about this, and I felt that it would be best to present it as a historical account, because it is, almost like a story, because it's his story, history. And I was not sure if that would be wise, and God used Amy the very next day to say, well, I remember when I was teaching it, my professor told me that the very best way to talk about Esther is to do it in the form of a dramatic story. Interesting. Happenstance or something that was meant to be? I would say things don't happen, that there are no coincidences. And throughout Esther, we see that time and time again. So Esther takes place in modern-day Iran, but the very first verse talks about this kingdom, the Persian and the Medes, the Medo-Persian Empire, that goes all the way from India to Ethiopia, which is in Africa. 127 provinces that this king had to control. And his name was Ahasuerus, or something very close. When I was working on it last night, I said it perfectly, but not today. His name also is Artaxerxes, as well as Xerxes. You see, they had multiple names, sometimes depending on the region and who was talking about him. So when the Bible talks about Xerxes in the book of Nehemiah, Nehemiah 2:6 says, I was talking to the king with the queen sitting beside him. He's probably talking about this guy, King Xerxes, and Queen Esther. It takes place right in between Ezra, chapter 6 and 7, if you wanted to look. That's how all these things work together. So people felt that this was just a story, a novel. But we look at it, and the things that it says about the Persian culture are right on. The things that it says about Xerxes is right on. The things that it mentions in the historical period are right on. And a historian named Herodotus speaks about some of similar events. So we can take it as history, not just a novel. And it's God working in a dramatic way that I think some of our novels are based off of. Well, what happened? This king, he loved to show off his glory. And for 180 days, he brought people in from all over to come and gawk at what he had done, his greatness and his amazing ability. So that's 6 months that he did this. And at the end of that time, he figured it wasn't enough. So for 7 more days, he threw another banquet. And for this one, he had as much wine and food and everything that you could want. And his queen, Queen Vashti at the time, had her own banquet. And so the 7 days went on, and he was getting very merry in heart, is what it says. But what that means is he kept his goblet full. He kept drinking wine so much that he was drunk. And what he did at the end of those times, he was like, hey, attendants, I want you to go get my queenie, Vashti. I want you to go get her and bring her here so my drunk friends could look at her because she's really beautiful. And that's exactly what he did. So the attendants went and go talk to Queen Vashti. Of course, Queen Vashti looks at them, looks at what's going on, is like, why would I want to parade myself in front of these drunk men? Logical, right? But you can't disobey the king's order. The attendants went back and told him what had gone on. So the king, he was furious. He loves wine, he loves to be angry, and he loves women. Those are his 3 biggest things. So after this, he was extremely furious about what was going on. He talked to his advisors, and you know what they said? They said, you need to send her away. You need to divorce her. And I like how they say it in Esther chapter 1, verse 17 says, for the queen's behavior will be made known to all women, causing them to look at their husbands with contempt, since they will say, King Ahasuerus commanded Queen Vashti to be brought for him, and she didn't come. This very day, the noble women of Persia and Media who have heard of the queen's behavior will say the same to all the king's officials, and there will be contempt and wrath in plenty. So they were more concerned about what Queen Vashti, her example, would do for the other wives of the kingdom. Weird, because I hope that we elevate our wives to such a high and noble status that we don't think of them as possessions, as mine. But in that society, they were viewed as possessions. So these advisors said, well, they have to obey me. So since the queen didn't obey you and you're the king, they're going to say, I don't have to listen. So that's why they said, send her out. and he liked that idea. He was drunk too, so he divorced her and she went on her way. Finally, chapter 2, he sobers up. And what happens when you sober up, I hear, is that you start to get logical again. You start to think. And so he starts to wonder, oh man, what did I do? I sent away my queen. And now he has to live with that. So his advisors, probably the same ones, they say, hey, king, we have an idea for you. We have this here map of your entire kingdom. I want you to look at it. It's the whole kingdom. And we think you should go throughout the kingdom and get all the beautiful young women and bring them here. They'll stay here forever. And you choose just one of them to be your queen. He's like, ooh, okay, I'll do that. So he looks at the map. He says, I want you to go here to look for my queen. He sends out his messengers, who were highly trained to be some of the fastest ever, to go out to all his provinces and say, I want you to handpick all the most beautiful young women that you can and bring them here. The problem with that is that you couldn't say no. So raise your hand if you have a daughter or you are a daughter here. I have two. You would have no choice. Your family would have to say, here you go. And the problem with these kind of things is that they stayed with the king forever. So the families had to give up their daughters forever. Well, this one person, his name was Mordecai. He was actually the cousin to the girl that he was taking care of. Her parents had died, and he basically raised her as his own daughter. Her name was Esther, and she was beautiful, and he did love her very much. But she was part of this thing, and she was gathered up and told that she had to go and get ready for the king. So for 12 months, they had to go have spa treatments, pedicures, manicures, massages, scalp rubs, whatever you think you might like. They had to do that for 12 whole months. And then they had to be presented before the king. And he had to choose just one as his new queen. Well, verse 17 of chapter 2, and I have it on the screen for you. It says, the king loved Esther more than all the women, and she won grace and favor in his sight, more than all the virgins, so that he set the royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. It just happened that he chose this girl named Esther, raised by this man named Mordecai. Just happened. So the story could end there, because this girl that was poor, probably, is now part of the king's entourage. She is the queen. Though she might not have power, because Queen Vashti didn't have power, she's still put in this great treatment, and she's royalty. Well, Mordecai, right before she becomes, she goes into this beauty treatment, he says, don't tell them that you're a Jew. I don't think he knew why. He probably had some inclination, but she listened to him. That's one of the things about Esther, is she's humble enough to listen to advice and to follow it. So if you want to emulate someone, Esther would be worth it. Soon we're going to see, not only is she humble, but she is bold enough to make decisions and to follow them. So Esther, she becomes this queen, and she, I would say everything is going well. We don't know how long things have gone on as it was. But soon we get to this next incident, and it's when Mordecai finds that there's a plot to kill the king. And it's verse 23 of chapter 2. When the affair of the plot to kill the king was investigated and found out to be so, the men were both hanged on the gallows. And it was recorded in the book of the Chronicles of the presence of the king. So Mordecai, her uncle, Esther's uncle, who they didn't know was her uncle, happened to be in the right place at the right time to see these guys and listen to them plot against the king. And it happened to be written into this book. But nothing happened to be done to reward him. Kings always reward those who please them. Okay, so now we're up to four or five happens for this whole book. Well, Haman, I don't know what he looks like, but I think this guy portrays him really well. Haman, he is elevated to the title of prime minister. He is the second highest in command under the king. And the king said, okay, now that you're going out, everyone has to bow to you. So he was walking out and going to and fro throughout the kingdom and excited about people bowing before him. But there's this one man. Can you guess who was the one man that would not bow? What do you think, Grace? Were you going to say Mordecai? Yes, it was Mordecai. Esther's uncle happened to be the one man that didn't bow. So this made him furious, so very angry, that he went to the king. One man ticked him off. He went to the king, and he says, okay, you know, I found out this man, Mordecai, he's a Jew. And you know, the Jews, they don't listen to us because they follow a different law. They follow their own rules. Well, maybe they follow the rules of their God. And we can't have that. Let's get rid of every one of them. Let's annihilate them. And the king, because, I don't know, he's like, okay, why don't you use my ring that has all my power and go and sign up whatever you want to do to these people, and do it in my name. So this guy, Haman, he goes and he writes it up. He says, okay, I'm going to throw these dice, and we're going to pick a day. That culture was called fate-driven. So they would use dice to be able to pick the day that they were deciding to do something. So he does this, and he picks a day months and months in advance. This roll is called the pur, or the P-U-R, pur. And it's done. He chooses this day, and he writes out this decree. The same fast horses go out and give it to all the provinces. All of the people in the towns start to weep and to wail over what had happened. And in the capital named Susa, they were wailing with great vigor. Well, one of the things that Mordecai got, because he was doing what was right, is like this. Whenever you live in a moral and upright way, you become a light that highlights the spiritual filth and moral decay of those around you. You stick out like a sore thumb. And because of that, you invite persecution from those whose deeds are evil. Exactly what Mordecai had happen. Well, have you ever felt that way? Have you ever felt like, I'm doing right, but other people are picking on me for doing right? You're in good company. But these people now were going to die for it. In the West, we don't have that problem as much. But would we be willing to die? Well, the story goes on, and in chapter 4, we actually see what happens. And let's look at verse 13 through 16. Then Mordecai told the attendants that Esther sent to him, because he was weeping and gnashing his teeth. He actually had like potato sacks on. We call them sackcloth. It's really gritty, and it hurts. It reminds you of being sorrowful. Esther, she sent him clothes, and he said, no, I don't want clothes. I'm mourning. And so he replies, tell Esther, do not think to yourself that in the king's palace you will escape any more than any other of the Jews. For if you keep silent at this time, relief and deliverance will rise from the Jews from another place, but you and your father's house will perish. And who knows whether you have not come into the kingdom for such a time as this. Then Esther told them to reply to Mordecai, go after all the Jews to be found in Susa and hold a fast on my behalf, and do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my young women will also fast as you do. Then I will go to the king, though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish." Mordecai then went away and did everything as Esther had ordered. So Mordecai was saying, maybe you were put in this position for this very time. And Esther says, "Then I want you to fast and pray for me. I need strength to be able to do this. Because if I approach him, because I haven't seen him for 30 days and he hasn't called me, I can die." And when she says, "If I perish, I perish," she's not just saying, "Okay, if I perish, I perish." But she's standing firm and saying, "Okay, I'm doing this, and if I perish, then I'm choosing to do it with courage and bravery. I will die in bravery because of what I'm doing." And there's something interesting about this guy Haman that I forgot to say. He was called an Agagite, which is a really fun thing to say, but it's actually from the king Agag. And back in, I think it was Kings or Samuel, God told Saul, King Saul, the king of Israel, to wipe out all the Amalekites, the ones that were Agag's people. And so Saul said, "Sure, I'll do it. I'll get rid of everything evil and those people." But he said, "I'm going to save that one guy." So many generations before, this one king was saved. And you know, as it went on, Haman was related to this one guy. So he had great animosity against the Jews, which probably explains why he wanted to kill them and get rid of them. So the Esther, she has to go up to the king, and she gets ready and prepared. She tries to probably look as beautiful as she can. And she goes before him. And when the king sees Queen Esther standing in the court, she won favor in his sight. And he held out to Esther the golden scepter that was in his hand. Then Esther approached and touched the tip of the scepter. So she went and she was prepared to die. If we put ourselves in her shoes, would we have been able to do that? If she had a heart rate monitor on her wrist when she was in that process, how high do you think her heart rate would have been? Probably off the scales. And yet she boldly did it. And that's pretty awesome about Esther. She was humble, she was beautiful, and she was bold. And she approached the king, and the king looked upon her with great favor. And she said, well, he said, "Queen, what can I do for you? I'll give you whatever you ask, even if it's half of my kingdom," which is just a fancy Shakespearean way of saying, "I'll give you anything." And Queen Esther, she's very smart too. She says, "Well, I would like to invite you to a banquet that I have prepared for you. And I'd like you to bring Haman too, because he's second in command." And the king says, "Absolutely, we'll be there." So they go to this banquet, and it's a great banquet. There is wine, of course, because that's what he drinks all the time. But he's also a smart man. He knows that it's easier to catch flies with honey than with vinegar. So what? He knows that Esther is trying to tell him something, but she's not telling him. So he says, "Okay, why do you want me to be here?" She said, "Well, I would like you to come back tomorrow for another banquet that I will prepare in your honor. I'd like you to bring Lord Haman too. And I promise I'll tell you what it is." And he says that he loves her and that he will come. And of course, Haman can come too. So you think that at this time, Haman's going to be really joyful. Well, verse 5:9. "And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart." Here he is, he's prime minister. He probably has a lot of money. He had just offered the king 700,000 pounds of silver so he could kill all the Jews. And he was on top of the world. But there was one man who would not bow to him. And his name was Mordecai, the very same guy that wouldn't do it. And so he neither rose nor trembled before him, and Haman was filled with wrath against Mordecai. So we have all this kind of stuff. Mordecai happened to be there at that day, and Haman happened to see him at that day. Well, he goes and he tells his wife and his friends. And his wife, she doesn't like him to be upset, so she thinks of some way to comfort him. And this is a bizarre way of trying to comfort him. She says, why don't you go and build a 75-foot gallows? And, you know, tomorrow morning, you go to the king and say, I want to kill Mordecai on this. In Hebrew, the gallows is actually a pole. So it could have been similar to the way the Romans crucified people. Any kind of thing like that, if you thought about it, is a form of painful death. So he builds this gallows all through the night. He's awake, and maybe he got people working on it. Maybe he did it himself. But on the other side of town, the king is awake too. And we're now in chapter 6, verse 1. On that night, the king could not sleep. He just happened to be awake. And he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the chronicles that were read before the king. Now, he was an amazing guy. And he would have had many volumes of his legends of awesomeness. And so this servant, he opens it up somewhere in the middle, because he's done a lot of great things. And he starts reading to them. He tells them all about all his great things and his great wisdom. And now he's on to his wars. And, O king, I remember the battle that you fought against Sparta, against those 300 men. And, you lost against them. But, you came back and you sacked Athens. So good job, king. Oh, and you got kicked out a year later. Hey, here, someone actually saved you. Let me read it. These guys, Bigthan and Teresh, they were trying to plot against you to assassinate you, to get rid of you. And a man named Mordecai foiled this plot. He happened to be in the right place at the right time. And the king stops him. He says, did we ever do anything for him? And the attendant, he says, no, we didn't. So the king starts trying to figure out what's going on, how he can help honor this guy who honored him. And lo and behold, Haman, whose wife told him to go early in the morning to go ask to kill Mordecai, happened to be in the court. The king hears it, or he's told, and he says, who's in the court? Who's out there? And Haman comes into his presence. And the king is excited, and Haman's excited. So they probably both start talking at the same time. And Haman says, oh, you go first. And the king says, I will. And so the king tells him, well, what should I do to honor someone that pleases me? And Haman, he starts thinking about things. He starts wondering, okay, is there anyone else in this kingdom that deserves that honor? Actually, is there anyone else that pleases him? I don't think so. So this must be about me. So I'm going to tell you what I want to do. And this is what he said. Oh, king, let's see. Let him come in. So Haman. And Haman said to the king, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let royal robes be brought, which the king has worn. So the king's own robes. And the horse that the king has ridden, his own horse. And the crown, the royal crown, that is the king's, be placed upon him. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor, and let them lead him on the horse throughout the square of the city, the most busy part of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. So the king is really excited. And then the king says to Haman, Haman's probably hardly containing himself. He's probably bouncing up and down because he's excited. Hurry, take the robes and the horses you have said, and do so to Mordecai the Jew, who sits at the king's gate, leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, "Thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor." But he obeys the king. So after this little escapade, he is really frustrated and probably embarrassed. So he rushes home, probably with his head down, rushing right to his house. And he gets there and he starts to tell his wife and his friends about what had happened to him. And they actually say, "You know, Mordecai is a Jew. And I think this is your downfall. I think you're doomed." And as they were saying that, maybe even that very word, the king's two attendants come and say, "Okay, it's time for the banquet." So he's taken away, maybe in mid-sentence, to go to this banquet that the queen has prepared. Remember, the night before he made the gallows to kill Mordecai on. This day he has just honored Mordecai, just told about what had happened to him, and now he's going to another banquet with Queen Esther and the king. And they have this banquet, and it seems to be going very well. He might have been a little worried because of what his wife said, but still they continue on with what was planned. And Esther, she finally gets the opportunity to say something. The king says, "Okay, Esther, now that we're on the second banquet, what is it that you would like? I will give you up to half of my kingdom." So she says, and it's better to read it, "Then Queen Esther answered, 'If I have found favor in your sight, O king, and if it please the king, let my life be granted me for my wish, and my people for my request. For we have been sold, I and my people, to be destroyed, to be killed, and to be annihilated. If we had been sold merely as slaves, men and women, I would have been silent, for our affliction is not to be compared with the loss to the king.'" Meaning he would have gotten a lot of money for it if he had at least sold them as slaves. "But the king Ahasuerus said to Queen Esther, 'Who is he and where is he? Who has dared?' And Esther said, 'A foe and enemy, this wicked Haman.' Then Haman was terrified before the king and the queen." So Haman, the descendant of Agag, King Agag, who Saul saved because of a sin, who Saul didn't wipe out, and the sin compounded and compounded and compounded till the Jews were about to be annihilated. This very man is now sitting on the hot seat. So the king, he runs outside and he goes to the garden, probably to think, because I don't know if he knew what to do at that moment. And that's when Haman tries to remedy the situation and try to fall on the mercy of Esther. In chapter 7, verse 7, it says, "And the king arose in his wrath from the wine drinking, and went into the palace garden. But Haman stayed to beg for his life from Queen Esther, for he saw that harm was determined against him by the king. And the king returned from the palace garden to the place where they were drinking wine, as Haman was falling on the couch where Esther was." It probably looked pretty bad. "And the king said, 'Will he even assault the queen in my presence, in my very own house?' And as the word left the mouth of the king, they covered Haman's face." This was a sign of a death penalty. So immediately they put something over his face. And I'm not sure why this happened, but it happened. One of the king's attendants said, "You know what? Haman, he had made these gallows, and he was going to kill Mordecai on them." "What? He was going to kill the one that I honored? Okay, where are these gallows?" And the attendant probably said, "Well, they're in Haman's backyard." And then the king says, "Well, go kill him on it instead of Mordecai." So Haman was killed on the very gallows that he had set aside for Mordecai the Jew. You would think that the story would be done there, and it wasn't. Because now the decree that he had made through Haman had to be remedied. But the problem with the Persians and the Medes is that their laws cannot be revoked. What that would look like is that the king made a stupid decision, and he has to save face. So he says, I'm sorry, that it can't be revoked. But Mordecai, whom he's now made prime minister, he's given Haman's possessions to him. He says, well, I think I have an idea for you. What if instead of it's like the lions attacking the lambs, what if we allow the lambs to defend themselves? So the king says, man, that's a great idea. Why don't you take my ring, because I don't make any laws myself, and you write whatever you want down. And so Mordecai and Esther write down all these things about how the Jews can defend themselves, how they can accumulate people to be able to be prepared for this day that comes. And they sent it out on those fast horses to all the provinces. And unlike when the city, the capital, was sad because of the Jews being killed, now they were extremely happy. And because of all this, several people actually became Jews. So their witness of Esther and Mordecai led others to the God of Israel. And so the day comes, and the Jews indeed do stand up. They use the feet that they were given by God to be able to defend themselves. And they are not annihilated. Flash forward to 1939, maybe 1933, when Blitzkrieg happened. And this man named Adolf Hitler felt like he wanted to exterminate all the Jews in the world. Do we have any Jews here today with us, still alive? Yes, because God watches out for his people. And so you read about these stories in the war, like when it was D-Day, and Hitler thought that he knew where he wanted to have his positions placed. And he said, no, they're going to attack at this other position. And yes, the beaches that we landed on were fortified and were guarded, but they weren't as heavily fortified as could have been. They weren't backed up as they would have been. It just happened that way. Just like Esther happened. I don't think so. I think that the truth is that when we think that God is silent, he's actually there and doing mighty things. So there's two principles to take away from Esther. And the first one is that God is there and he is not silent. God doesn't show up. He's always there. My favorite verse is Hebrews 13:5, and it helped me through my childhood, many dark times. But it says, I will never leave you, and I will never forsake you. And to me, that is the greatest promise. So even when there's silence, God is there. And you know that crazy poem that really is good, but in the 80s, every single mom in the world had it on their wall. It's called Footprints in the Sand. It talks about how a person was walking and there was two sets of footprints. And as they were walking along, he noticed that there's only one set of footprints after a while. And he asked why that is. He says, well, where is God? I thought God said he would always be with me. But God replies, I was carrying him through those times. So God is there and he is not silent. Though sometimes he speaks in only a whisper, just like Elijah found out. God is the missing character. And I think one of the reasons this is in the Bible is because the Jews had to figure out, does God really care about me? I'm in exile. I was kicked out of my home. And now I don't know what to do. Would God also be with me in Persia, away from the land that God had promised Abraham? But God's presence and his behind-the-scenes activity, which we call divine providence, not happens. That is, God's continuous care for his creation was there. And even though the Jews wondered, God was orchestrating things to have happened. So for us, at times, it's going to seem like God is hiding, that he is not there. But seen or unseen, he's orchestrating events in our lives. Romans 8:28 says, God works all things together for our good, to to those who love him and are called according to his purpose. So if you have to go away with something, go away knowing that even when God appears to be absent, he is present and active in our lives. And then the second application is, you were made for such a time as this. For me, I've wondered what God was doing in my life. After college, Amy and I moved up here. We had one kid. And I knew that I had to get a job, so I was going to get a job as a medical records clerk at Tana Valley Clinic. I go in, and I apply for that position, but as they were doing it, they're saying, well, we need someone to do collections. And I don't think I ever knew what that term was, but I also knew that I needed a job. So I said, sure, I'll do it. So for 2 years, I had to call people and tell them that we're going to send them to these really bad people that are going to take their money and ding their credit if they don't pay me. I had a very tough time with that. But how God used it, like the second or third day in, the manager, she said, hey, we're doing a new computer program. Is there anyone that knows computers? And so I raised my hand. And she said, okay, I want you to be part of this brand new computer program that we're going to use for the entire clinic. Help implement it. So even though I was in collections, now I was starting to be able to work in computers. And God used that time to grow my skills. And eventually I was hired in IT, and I stayed there for a long time. Worked at the university in IT, worked for a podiatrist in IT, and you wonder, okay, why am I here doing non-IT stuff? Because God has used every single one of those events to bring me to such a time as this. To prepare my heart to be ready to speak his word, even though I am extremely nervous all the time. He gives words to say, and I have to be like Esther, where I say, if I stumble, if I sweat to death, if my face is red, if people boo me, I will stand up and proclaim what God has asked me to say. So God, he has an infinite number of ways to accomplish his will. And if we refuse to listen, it's our choice. But it's not going to stop his plan. It just means he's not going to use you or me. And it means that his best for us is going to be delayed. So human choices absolutely can happen. But really what we need to do is be humble before God, accept his advice, and boldly do it, just like Esther. So now as we celebrate our freedom and remember those brave people that fought for that, we need to remember how Esther was brave. That if the Jews weren't preserved, Jesus, he still would have been born. It would have just been in a different way. Jews would have been some remnant preserved, and Jesus would have been born. But this way, they were brought back to the promised land. And this is how we've gotten here, to learn about Jesus now. So God is in control today, just as he was in control of the events in Persia. Though God's name was not in the story, his invisible hand moved throughout its pages. I think we're up to 10 things that just happened. So is there any doubt in your mind that God was orchestrating things to make these things happen? We're all done, but the two applications, again, God is there and he is not silent. And God actually has a strategic plan for you for this very moment in your lives. What is it? Let's pray. God, thank you again for this time. Help us to be sensitive to your leading, to know what you want us to do, and to boldly follow it. In Jesus' name, amen.